At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
Hey, do you mind if I talk about me for a second? Or an hour, or however long this episode ends up being? So, I wrote this book. It's called Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire. Now, normally, with it being Halloween on Friday, I would drop, like, an original short story about witches and ghosts and whimsy and folklore and magic and all sorts of stuff like that, except I kind of already did that, except it wasn't a short story. It was a big old novel. It was actually a New York Times best-selling novel, and it was also a USA Today best-selling novel and an indie best-selling novel. It was actually a pretty cool experience, and I have been champing at the bit to talk to you about it here on this podcast, but I thought that would be really weird if I talked to myself about it, or if I just got on here and like speechified at you about the book. So instead, I asked a journalist to do journalism at me. Nadira Goff is a staff culture writer at Slate. She's actually already been a guest here on this show. She's going to talk about it here in just a second. But she came back on. She was super cool. She agreed to come back on and, like, do journalism at me. And there are several times in this interview when I don't think I was fully prepared to talk about my own book on my own podcast. I think I've gotten so used to asking other people questions that I didn't entirely understand the process of getting asked, like, good questions. But hopefully I didn't screw it up too bad. Anyways, here's Nadira Goff and me.
Hi, Don Martin. Welcome to Head on Fire. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Nadira.
Of course. For those of you who might be confused, as this is usually Don's own show, let me explain. My name is Nadira Goff. I am a part-time chocoholic, full-time culture writer at Slate, all-time fangirl. Don was kind enough to invite me onto his show a few months ago for an episode titled, What Even Is Pop Culture Anymore?, which is available wherever you're listening to this right now. And if you do go listen to that episode, you can hear the very fun and sort of wacky story as to how some low-grade TikTok beef actually started our burgeoning and beautiful friendship. And if you're thinking, Nadira, that's all very nice and well, but it still doesn't explain why the hell you're introducing Don on his own show, then you would be right. You see, our dear Don, he wrote a book, an instant New York Times bestseller, an instant USA Today bestseller, an instant indie bestseller. The book is called Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire, and I'm here to talk to Don about his own book, for which first, I know you're probably tired of hearing me talk, but I will give you all a quick rundown introduction. So, Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire. It's a young adult novel, which is great because even though I am pushing 30, that is still what I like to think of myself as. And perhaps what I like to think of all adults as, because I don't like the fact that I'm getting old. It's fine. It follows the titular girl, Verity Vox, who gets a mysterious message that beckons her to the town of Foxfire. However, Foxfire, no ordinary town. Verity, no ordinary girl. She's a witch in training. And Foxfire, a forgotten coal mining town, is suffering from two distinct tragedies. The first, Foxfire sits in a valley at the base of an Appalachian mountain where it was connected to the outside world only by one singular wooden rope bridge that has since gone to rot, therefore isolating everyone in the town from the outside world. The second, the town, of course, has been cursed by a powerful entity lurking in the mountain and the surrounding woods, which all seems tied to a cunning, sinister magician who used to live in the town before he was driven out for swindling the townsfolk, the desperate townsfolk, into making deals to better their isolated lives for hidden prices too steep to pay. So after receiving that cryptic message, Verity sets out to Foxfire to break this curse, which should be something a skillful young witch with a can-do attitude is perfectly capable of. Though she will find out that nothing about Foxfire is that easy, and not everything nor everyone is what they seem. And the only thing she can trust is the town's own advice to don't look in the trees. Don, congrats. I'm very excited for you, of course. So you based Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire on a real town, that being of Volk, West Virginia. Can you tell me and us, like there's a whole quorum of people here, can you tell me and us more about Vulcan, its history, and what about it inspired you to write Verity Vox?
Yeah, Vulcan was, first of all, thank you for that introduction.
Of course.
This is the most magical experience, like hearing a pop culture writer, pop culture, your book back at you. That is such an honor. So thank you so much. Vulcan, West Virginia was like a lot of industry towns that we have in the U.S. It was built for an industry. It was built to house people to live someplace so that they could work for a particular company. These industry towns exist all over the U.S. Rochester, New York. You and I were together in New York City. Rochester, New York is one such industry town. It was kind of built up around a Kodak factory. And when the Kodak factory shut down a little over a decade ago, that created quite a lot of problems. Appalachia, West Virginia specifically, has a lot of industry towns that are specifically coal mining towns. Back when coal mining was pretty much the only business inside of West Virginia, and a lot of areas in Appalachia follow suit. West Virginia's mining industry was fairly unique in that it was extremely integrated. If you start looking into kind of the untold history of the mining wars happened in Appalachia, specifically in West Virginia, a lot of people were brought in to West Virginia to be black folks from the South, Italians, Irish, back when Italian and Irish weren't technically white for some reason. Yeah. There were a lot of these coal mining towns that were created all over as a place to house the people that worked for the coal company, because we used to feed bodies to the mountain in order to dig out coal and make a whole bunch of money for rich people. It destroyed the land, it destroyed resources, and it destroyed communities. But it was also the only source of wealth at all in these areas. So Vulcan is a real town. It's a real town in the heart of a valley at the base of a mountain. I went there just a few weeks ago, or I guess a couple of months ago now. It was unique amongst these coal mining towns because the only way into or out of it was a swinging bridge. It was a bridge made of wood and rope, and it didn't even exist when the town was originally built. The people who lived there had to lobby the mining company to build it for them, because before that, the only way they had to get to work was to row a boat across a river. Every day they got up, they had to go down into the mines to dig the coal out. And in order to get there, they had to row a boat across the river. When kids needed to get to school, row a boat across the river. If people died, row a boat across the river. It was not great. So they lobbied the coal mining company to build a bridge, and they did so. And it was a crappy little swinging bridge. And if nobody knows what a swinging bridge is, if you've ever seen an Indiana Jones movie, it's one of those.
Yeah. Yeah. The scary
bridge
one.
Made of wood and rope.
The ones you don't actually want to cross.
Nope. Little rickety little swinging bridge. And one day when the coal ran out, the mining company was like, so there's no more reason for us to be here. Good luck. And they just left, which meant there was no more industry in the area, which meant there was no more money in the area, which meant that all the people who lived there were kind of screwed. And there was also no money, no industry, no company keeping up the roads and bridges or bridge. And eventually, decades later, the bridge went out. It was destroyed. It fell into the river below and was carried away, and the people in the town were trapped. Now, in the real world version of Vulcan, there were indeed mountain roads that you could take to get off of the mountain, but they were long, they were skinny, they were precarious, they were incredibly dangerous, and it still came with the risk of running into the train, running into a vehicle. There was maybe like a thumb length of distance between a car and either side of the road if a car could actually make it up there. This was untenable. The people of Vulcan tried to get assistance, tried to get some help. They went to their local government, their state government, the federal government. Every time they were told, no, they're not important enough. There's no budget for it. The governor's office in West Virginia, they actually made it to the governor's office at one point, and he was like, let's fix this for you. He picked up the phone and he was quoted as saying, I want this real bridge built immediately. Turns out he was calling his assistant in the next room and he had no intention of actually rebuilding that bridge. He was just trying to put on a show for the people. They contacted the federal government. Again, everybody was like, you're not important enough. There's no money. Good luck out there. Sorry about it. So they got a little creative and they decided to make a deal with the devil. And they reached out to the Russian government, of all people. And at first, Russia was also like, this sounds like a joke. This can't be real. But a journalist working in Moscow at the time heard about the plight of the people of Vulcan, and they thought this was pretty interesting. So they went and researched and they went over there. And Russia realized, like, hey, all you want is a bridge, and we could get one over on the U.S. government for not taking care of their own people on their own soil. And all you all to do all of that, all we have to do is rebuild a bridge for you. Yes, we will happily rebuild a bridge. We will build a bridge for you. No problem. Within 1 hour of the Russian government agreeing to build the bridge, the state of West Virginia called and they were like, hey, by the way, we found some bridge money for you. Tell the Russians to get lost. Mm. Self-appointed mayor, because there was no government in Vulcan. His name was John Robinette. He's a really interesting character. The self-appointed mayor, whenever the bridge was opened a year later, christened it with two bottles of Russian vodka and was like, here, yay, thanks to the Russians for getting us a bridge. So the town is real. The people are real. The bridge is real. And it's just kind of another story about how of what happens whenever we treat people like things, when we treat people like commodities, when we treat people like employees rather than humans, and the way that we kind of write people off because of where they live and how they live and how much money they have and that kind of thing. So in my story, it's the deal with the devil's a little bit more literal, but it's still a town in the heart of a valley at the base of a mountain. And, you know, I think mine's filled with a little bit more magic, but hopefully the heart of the story is the same.
And when about did the whole reaching out to Russia, West Virginia government being like, hey, just kidding, we'll build this bridge. When about did all of that happen?
That was the 70s, actually. So all of this took place in the mid 70s. I want to say start to finish, all of this took place over the course of like 4 or 5 years, something like that. Don't quote me, but you can go look up the original articles in the New York Times from the 70s. It was actually really interesting. This little old lady, this bridge might not have been built, had a little old lady who lived in Vulcan not ordered some furniture from up north. And when the furniture was being delivered, the truck driver got all the way out there, which to get all the way out to Vulcan is already a whole thing, but got all the way out there and realized that there was no way to get the furniture to her. Mm-hmm. Because he was like, I'm not crossing a bridge. I'm not crossing a river. And I'm certainly not taking those little precarious little old mountain roads. Absolutely not. Sorry about that. And so John Robinette was like, well, this won't do. We need to get this nice little old lady her furniture. Yeah. So, but yeah, it was the mid 70s and the bridge was open in 1980.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Yeah. Okay. What I find really interesting about all this, besides the fact that it's real and that it has happened, is that this is a story that very easily, I mean, it could have been nonfiction. It could have been fiction, but for adults, it could have been predominantly characterized through male characters. But instead, you decided to write a young adult novel with mostly women as the characters, young women, and in the fantasy world. How did that come to you? How did you decide that, oh, this is where this story needs to be?
So the story is a love letter to a lot of things. It's a love letter to, obviously, the place. West Virginia is where I was born. Half my family's there. They've been there since the late 1700s. I have a deep, deep, deep love for West Virginia. It's always been the most magical place on earth to me. I mean, every time we had a vacation, every time we had a holiday, every time we took a trip, we weren't a family that went to Disneyland. We weren't a family that went off to, you know, some vacation here, there, or the other. We went to go see family in West Virginia. And so to me, that place was always the most magical. I first heard the story of Vulcan, oh God, probably 15 years ago. I mean, just forever and ever and ever ago. And I was like, man, a town in a mountain and the only way into or out of it is a bridge. And what if the bridge went out? That sounds like it should be a story. Somebody should write that. And I held on to that for years and years and years and years. And I always thought, you know, what would the story be? What would the story be? And, you know, I'm a big fan of witches in media. I mean, I write a lot about witches, fiction, nonfiction, and beyond. And I love stories of traveling witches, Kiki's Delivery Service, or Elena, the Wandering Witch, or there's a lot of stories of student witches, traveling witches, witches that have to go off in the world and, you know, hone their skills and, you know, make good and stuff like that. And I thought, what if that took place here? why does it have to take place in a proto-European world? Or why does it have to take place in the Mediterranean? Or why does it have to, you know, I always thought, you know, we've got some of the most magical, fantastical spots right in our own backyard. Why don't we romanticize those? Why don't we fantasize those? I thought, what if a witch had come to that lost, forgotten mountain town? And how would she help? But also, why would she be there? Why a witch? And what exactly is keeping the people in the town from, you know, getting out? And, you know, what if it was a little worse than that? You brought up that it's a cast of mostly women. And there is a good reason for that. One, it's also a love letter to the many strong women in my family. Almost everybody in the book outside of the main cast, so not Verity, not Tacita, not Gilly, but almost pretty much everybody else in the town of Foxfire and beyond are all named for people in whole or in part from my family tree who lived and died in that area around the time the story is set. And it also is just kind of a love letter to what happens to towns whenever war happens, whenever tragedy happens, whenever industry happens. The men go off to war, the men go off to industry, the men go off to work, and the women end up being the people who run everything, being the people who keep the town going, and they end up taking charge. If you've ever seen, there's a really phenomenal TV series that's actually starring Eva Longoria on Apple TV called In the Land of Women. It's a brilliant bilingual show. It's actually so good. It's really, really good. Eva Longoria is like on the run from the law. So of course she goes to Spain, I think.
Right.
To like a winery,
something
her family owns or something. I don't remember, but it was like, it was talking about how during the war, the women, you know, ended up becoming in charge of everything. And that's why the town seems to still be run by women. And, you know, in my family, it was the matriarchs that ran everything. My granny was, you know, kind of the head of the family, my grandmother. And that was the same on both sides. Both sides of my family have really strong women. And so it was just only natural for me to, you know, have women run the town of Foxfire.
Yeah. And we're going to talk a lot about place and girlhood because, well, I am a girl, and so I'm always thinking about girlhood. But also, I'm from Pennsylvania, which is not too far from West Virginia at all, and I think has a lot of the similar, I mean, is a coal mining state, has incredible sort of stories and landscape that I think is often overlooked, very mountainous. I think that we have a lot of sort of similarities in that regard. However, I think the one sort of large distinction there is West Virginia is the South and Pennsylvania is not. And so there's a lot about this book that I love because of its place and its setting. And it gets to talk a lot about the sort of more delicious social aspects of Southern living and Southern identity and small town living and small town identity. And one of the ones that I want to talk about, though I will be asking you about like five more, is gossip. The book talks about gossip as, you know, an invitation, as communal activity, as a form of bonding, as tradition, as self-preservation and community preservation. You write, "If you have never lived in a small town, you may not be aware that there exists something that is very like magic while not being magic at all. Gossip." And then later on, you even break down the rules of gossip, which I found genius and charming. It reminded me a lot of, not to be that theater kid in the room, but the moment in Hamilton where they explain the sort of 10 commandments of a duel, right? It reminded me of that. Like, these are the sort of precursors and the rules of gossip. How do you use gossip in your own life? And why is it so important to small town living and to Verity and the town of Foxfire?
So I think that gossip being a kind of magic, there's a few types of magic that I talk about in the book that aren't magic at all. Gossip is one of them. Hospitality is one of them. Confession is one of them, though that's only mentioned very briefly towards the end. But I think that gossip is a way of talking about kind of the tension of how I feel about small towns. Like, I have a real, I mean, I grew up in a town of 585 people with 9 Baptist churches. There was, it's a real small town. And there's a lot that I wish hadn't been my childhood. There's a lot that I, you know, there's that love-hate relationship that a lot of queer folks, minorities of all types, have with small towns. there's a lot of also really beautiful parts about it. And I think gossip is a way of kind of discussing that tension, especially in a fantasy novel, especially one aimed at kids, because it can describe the kind of intimacy that people have with one another in small towns, where everyone seems to know everything about everybody. But it's also discussed, I think, in that same conversation where May and Verity are talking kind of about the truth of Tacita and the truth of Tacita's relationship with her mom and all of that, about how, like, you can feel like you know everything about everybody, but you don't actually know very much. Yeah. Like, you don't know deep stuff about what the other people in your town down the street from you. You don't actually really know what's going on behind closed doors. It can feel like everybody knows everything about everybody. And it can feel like when something happens, everyone in the town seems to know about it almost immediately. But, like, how people actually are, like, the deep, dark secrets that people have, folks, that's not part of it. So I think that gossip is just an interesting way to kind of discuss that tension of intimacy in those small spaces.
Yeah. And then in addition, and I mean, well, I guess even just to back up for gossip a little bit, it's something that, I mean, listen, everyone gossips. Everyone gossips. However, I do think it is mostly known as a feminine thing for a lot of, like, patriarchal, stereotypical reasons, but then also because I do think historically minority groups, that being women, that being queer people, that being people of color, have had to rely on gossip more to stay safe. How would you know that a sundown town is a sundown town if someone didn't gossip about what happened when they were going through it? You know what I mean? And so I think what's so interesting about it is it also plays into this idea of girlhood. Even though everyone gossips, it's like the sort of the fundamental, like the necessity of it in this town is also somewhat inherently feminine because the characters belong to this group that is often overlooked or, you know, underestimated. And in fact, they tend to be the characters, the women who are running this town and running the story. And so I thought that it fit in a way that also just made perfect sense for this book. Like, I was like, oh wow, like, I've never actually seen a book in words break down gossip, even if it had gossip in it, but also it makes perfect sense for this to be the one that sort of lays it out. Another thing that this book lays out, in addition to hospitality and the importance of, which I love, and the sort of southern politics of everything, is one of my favorite sections of this book, is where you have a few pages describing the importance of understanding the subtext that goes into a Southern insult. And I would like to read this bit because it is so dear to me. Okay, so you say, there are entire novels that could be written, treatises drafted, endless lectures created, all about what a certain kind of woman from a certain part of the world means when they say certain innocuous phrases, such as how nice, or bless your heart, or isn't that lovely? And none of them would come close to covering all of the many facets and layers of social positioning and meaning conferred in that handful of syllables. Break this down for the people who are unaware. And also, why is this such an important part of coming of age? Like, learning this, why is that such an important part of coming of age in the South?
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
God, well, it's survival. It's safety. Okay, without, like, turning this into, like, a whole, like, my weird murder board thing where I, like, start, you know, with the red thread and stuff. I think this particular, I think this particular truism comes from being a queer kid in a small town and having to be able to navigate safety. Grow up, you go to church and you're surrounded by like church ladies, right? And church ladies like love on everybody. And you're having to navigate whether somebody is actually has your best interests in mind, whether or not they actually care about you, or whether or not they're just like cozying up to you and like whether your confession is going to become a prayer request at next during Sunday school or something. There is this, gosh, and man, if you are somebody that takes things really literally, that must be an absolute nightmare to try to navigate. But there is like a whole politics around Southern nice. And I've learned it's the truth in the Midwest as well. Midwest nice is a whole thing and it's got its own rules as well. But there's like a whole rule system within the niceties, the pleasantries that people have with one another, especially in the South. Especially in that like small town church lady culture where, man, if you're not careful, you could end up as somebody's prayer request on Sunday. Like, you know, oh, bless her heart. I just want to lift up Susie Lou because, you know, she got so fat and her husband left her and she's got them three grandbabies at home. And I just feel so bad for her because, you know, her 15-year-old, she had two little girls of her own. And now she's Sandra Lee's Susie Lou's a grandmother with two kids at home. We just want to pray for her and lift her up. And we just love her. And I just, oh my gosh, I'm not explaining this very well at all.
Well, you're explaining it perfectly to me. I mean, I think what's really interesting to me about this, beyond the fact that it's really relatable, and another thing that people talk about, but perhaps not enough, is I feel like recently, and I don't know what the Instagram algorithm or whomever is serving me, but I've been getting a lot of videos of creators talking about how a lot is strong. More like three videos of creators talking about...
The three really good videos.
Right, exactly. No, but there are creators who are talking about how in Asian cultures, there's a sense of subtext that Americans just don't understand. And it's very much that thing of they will insult you openly, publicly, by complimenting you. And, you know, for example, if Americans are traveling through, let's say, Japan, and we're being really loud, then some at a restaurant, then someone might say, oh, wow, you guys have really strong voices, huh? Which is a way of saying, you know, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. My dad always said that my superpower, he was like, you know, man, I worked retail, I worked in restaurants, and like, you know, my dad, you know, they've sat in my section when I was a server at like Red Lobster.
and he was like, but. We'll move.
Girl, those don't taste like anything after a while. Like
That's so sad. Okay, sorry. He would say.
Okay, so my dad said that I have this superpower where he's like, you could be getting like a crowd of people go like, and they're all laughing with you and they will walk away from an experience with you fully believing that they had a great time and that you loved them and it was so much fun and they had a great time and they were laughing and everybody was having a good time. And 30 minutes later, when they are at home, they'll look at one another and say, man, that guy cut me lower than I have ever been cut before in my life. And I said, thank you. He's like, you have this talent for just like cutting people and making them say thank you and they will laugh with you. And I was like, thanks.
Well, I think what kind of pisses me off about that content is that as much as it is trying to break down perhaps hagiographic view of Asian cultures, because they're very trendy to many Americans now. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm super into K-dramas and K-pop and stuff, so I'm not going to excuse myself from that. However, it is also
Bon appetit,
somewhat,
Your Majesty.
I still need to watch this. You know what? Don't get me started. It is also, those videos are also cementing or creating a stereotype of America. And the thing about America is that it's huge. And it is incredibly regional and local in some of its tendencies and cultures. And I watch those videos and I'm like, no, that's not all Americans. If you've ever known somebody's auntie from Virginia or from Alabama, she will have told you 15 things that are wrong with you in a span of 3 minutes, all while, you know, crocheting you a doily and wishing you the best. Like that is, and you have to be discerning enough to catch that, or else you will miss it. And I love that your book sort of spells that out, as it's something that I guess is seen to be getting lost in translation in terms of this whole melting pot idea of America, which is a very diverse place.
Yeah, I said one time that because I'm also a poet, and I said, you know, one day I would like to write an entire collection of poems where it's just an examination of the word nice and how. Certain people use the word nice, because nice could mean like that really, like, I really like that thing. I want that thing. That is such a nice thing. Nice can be an insult. Oh, that restaurant's a little nice for us. It's, you know, it's too fancy. It's too hoity-toity. Nice can be, I mean, there's just so many layers to how it's almost like a tonal language or something.
Yeah. You know, when you hear those things the most, when certain groups are talking about babies and they're like, that's when you really, if you want to really get the lingo of how many different ways words like nice or interesting can be
interesting.
Used.
I was about to say my grandmother was so famous for that's just so interesting.
I am a big user of interesting. When
it's so
in fact,
it's
just me not being able to find a word nicer than that.
My grandmother could wield that interesting. It was a sight to behold.
And I feel as though me and your family would be great friends through reading this book. We might be like each other's biggest opponents, ops, but also each other's best friends. Like
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so. Another thing that I sort of love about how girlhood is depicted in this book, I don't sort of love it, I do actually love it. It's filler word, it's fine. And I don't think I necessarily need to outline the strong connections between fluidity of gender and sexuality and girlhood. I think knowing your identity and reading your book actually ties those two things together incredibly well.
What are you talking about? Honey, I'm straight.
My God, you're so straight. It's so lovely.
You're
and
so
I love
straight.
That for you. I love that for you. How does it feel being on the outside of hegemony? As a straight man, how does that feel? But yeah, I think, you know, when I say girlhood, I am talking about girlhood, but I'm also talking about all of the cultures that borrow from girlhood, that are a part of girlhood, that being queer people, that being gender fluid people. And what I love about its presentation in this book is, like we've been saying, women are the strongest forces of this book. They're so unbothered with the sort of things that we are told women often are concerned about. You know, never once does Verity worry about her appearance or being nurturing. There's a moment where her and her friend Tacita laugh because Verity has snot all over her face from crying. And instead of being like, oh, that's so gross, or I look so ugly right now, you know, they just laugh about it. And there's a moment where, you know, Verity says that she's not necessarily worried about saying something comforting. I think she specifically says, you know, saying something comforting felt futile, and witches don't dabble in futile, right? Like they dabble in action and change. And a lot of her worries are about being kind enough, fair enough, and particularly capable enough. That seems to be everyone's main worry in this book. Was avoiding those regular stereotypes of coming of age books for young women, was that a conscious choice?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm a big comic book fan. Big, long time comic book fan. Been reading comics as long as I've been reading, like, you know, Greek myths. So since elementary, middle school, they're very formative for me. And of course, like every 90s gay kid, all of my favorite characters were girls. Jean Grey and Emma Frost and Wanda Maximoff and, you know, all those badass, powerful women. Monet, we love an M. We love a confusing. Is she her twin sisters? Is she just her? I love them all. And I've always noticed how we punish young girl. We punish female superheroes for being too powerful. So the more powerful, the more assured, the more ownership and just capacity that they have, the more we have to punish them for it. For the powers that the writers gave them for some reason. And so I wanted to ensure, because I was very conscious, you know, I am a male writer writing a female protagonist. I wanted to be really conscious about ensuring that Verity's struggles are not with capability, are not with self-assurance, are not with, you know, feeling like she can't get the job done or something like that. She comes into the story powerful. She is powerful all the way through. Her power, however, isn't, she has to learn that magic isn't always enough. And there are other truths. There are other avenues to figuring out what right looks like for any particular person, community, place, situation, that kind of thing. Magic can only take you so far. And I just wanted to create a version of kind of that superhero that young kids could look up to, where that just wasn't an issue, where it just wasn't an issue. There was always self-assurance. There was always, and that's what I wanted to see. So I made it.
Well, yes, correct. Hello. I love it because I think what's so interesting, and I mean that interesting in a real way, not in the way that we were just talking about, is that, you know, all of the women that I know do both. We are, you know, very strong. We are very capable. We are also like, are my eyebrows fucked up? And how does this dress make me look? Right. And I think it is still, because like society will just give you that, whether it's in a good way or a harmful way, it will be given to you. But what felt so freeing was to have children's media without that, because you know that any young person, no matter who they are reading that book, is going to get that from society, that sort of constant worrisome about the self and appearance and how they're coming off to people. They're going to get that just from living. They don't necessarily need that in their fantasy. And so I really appreciated the fact that it was sort of left from the book. And to be honest, I didn't even notice until maybe halfway or 2/3 through. And I was like, wait, people have been asking her to wear something else except all black that whole time. And she's always been like, no, you know, like she's, you know, she's so sort of unconcerned about all the traditional girly things. However, she is concerned about a lot more very important stuff. And I have asked you this question in person, and I'm going to ask you this question again. I hope you remembered it, and I hope you came up with a good answer in the meantime. Okay, I often see many young adult books as dealing primarily in the concept of inheritance. Most often, characters are realizing that they have inherited something for the first time, whether it's a body with features they don't necessarily like, magical powers, or even the prophecy of being the chosen one. Verity, as a character, and you know many of her friends in Foxfire that she comes to make, have inherited so much, a curse, a host of problems from the previous generation, which also comes with generational trauma, and also more positive things, strength, resilience, maybe even a little magic that they didn't know that they had. How has inheritance impacted your own life? And what do you think this book is saying, if anything, about the concept of inheritance?
Well, I think that the book deals with inheritance really directly because the youngest people in the town have only ever known the consequences of the actions of the generations before, for good or for ill. Their parents, their grandparents did what they thought was right and stood up to a magical bully and kicked him out of town. And, you know, his vengeance, it creates the world in which they exist. So they do inherit everything. They inherit the boundaries of their world from the generation before, but they also inherit the feelings of people who were also used to never having a lot of agency of their own anyways, because before the town was trapped by Earl, the town was trapped by the wealthy. The town was trapped by the folks who owned the coal mining companies. And that in and of itself creates a lot of trauma, creates a lot of generational cycles, creates a lot of ways of existing that we don't even think of. You know, in the research for this book and hopefully future Verity stories, I remember being so shocked that the owners of the coal mining companies would build their houses so high up in the mountain that all of the dust and the debris and all of the stuff that was like giving everybody black lung, that was killing the people who worked in the mine and the towns, they built their homes up so high that they were quite literally above the disaster that they created. And there's consequences to that. So the people who lived in Foxfire, May specifically, directly remembers what it was like when the town was a coal mining town. Everybody in that town is dealing with, well, first we were this and now we were this and hopefully one day we can be something else. There's a lot of people in that town that have never really had agency. And I think that when you grow up in an environment like that, that is so dependent on others, you don't even realize that you're missing something. You start to forget what agency even looks like, what it feels like to be in charge of your own decisions. And I briefly mentioned that in the book, but it's still a book for kids, so I don't spend a ton of time on it. But I do briefly kind of dive into that topic. And I think that in many ways, like I said, a lot of it, from the naming, from the nomenclature to the place to, I mean, every single building described in the book is a real place. Most of the landscape, all of it's real. Even the mountains in the background of the cover art came from a photo that I took of the mountains in West Virginia. Yeah. So in a lot of ways, the book is directly dealing with my own inheritance and my own, you know, understanding of my place and my family tree and what it means for all of these other people to have existed and lived and been who they were and thought how they thought and loved how they loved and hated who they hated and, you know, all the good and bad decisions. And it led to I'm here now. And what do I do with the inheritance of this? What does it mean to inherit a family legacy? Such as it is. I mean, you know, every child has a family legacy of some kind, has a family tree. So what does it mean to inherit that? How do I carve my own name in the ever-growing family tree trunk? And so a lot of that's contended with, both for the people of Foxfire and for myself as the author processing his own kind of middle age, coming of age on the page.
Yeah, and what I will sort of take with me is I think most, but so I only had this realization recently, maybe a few, half a year ago, that most young adult books are could sort of be couched under one big umbrella theme of inheritance, more so than I think books written for adults. And what I will sort of take with me is I think most books are either about rejecting that or accepting it. And sometimes, usually, it's a journey of starting as one and ending up as the other. But Verity, I think specifically, is about maybe accepting or rejecting it, but then eventually accepting it and turning it into something new or something different. And that's a sort of, it's like a third path.
Yeah, Verity's thing. Magic. Verity doesn't do a lot of big, really splashy magic in the book. She mostly heals and mends and fixes things and stuff like that. And it's so interesting that you're talking about, you know, do I either embrace the legacy that I've been given and make the best of it, or do I take the legacy that I've been given and transform it into something new? And Verity is surrounded by people who make both decisions. Gilly is somebody who directly tells her, why would I want to leave? This is my home. We don't want to leave. This is our home. Why should we be forced to leave just because somebody else is pulling the strings, basically. We should get to have our own agency and decide to defend our home. Whereas Tacita, who also grew up in the same town, says, yeah, I want to leave. I want to know what life is like somewhere else. I want to know what it's like to get lost in a crowd. I want to know what it's like beyond the bridge. I want to imagine what life is like beyond the horizon. I mean, all that Gilly has really ever seen is the ridge, is the horizon line of the mountains. And you know, one person says this is home and one person says home is somewhere else. And, you know, the book is dedicated to the people and places that I've called home. And each of those women find home in one of those. Home is a place and home is people. Mm-hmm. And for Tacita, I think home is people. And for Gilly, home is her place. They each have found family. And it's not that they don't have aspects of both, but I think that they each represent, you know, kind of that part of me that's contending with what does it mean, you know, where do I call home and why do I call home home, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really funny to me that in the discussion about inheritance, you said you don't get too into it because it is a book written for kids. However, you do get into some really, and I'm going to say it, gross things. This book is, I mean, it's great when it comes to body horror. There's a lot of really well-written, very visceral body horror scenes, Why?
I didn't know how to write any other book. I didn't know any other way. I mean, one, I think kids can take a lot more than people seem to think they can. Girl, some of the stuff in Goosebumps was taking me out. Girl, like some of the stuff. I mean, listen.
And you said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pass that on.
I'm going to give that to a new generation.
Yep.
Y'all deserve the same. I mean, I don't know. I think that there are ways of communicating information to kids, especially. And the body horror elements are almost a kind of subtext, like information that you need about Matthew and kind of his role in the story, but more so communicating what it meant to feed bodies to a mountain and for generations of people to feed bodies, mostly men, but boys. Men, boys, feed male bodies to the mountain in order to survive for another day. I can't sit there and have a whole conversation about sociopolitical and economic dynamics, but I can communicate to you what the ravages of going to the mountain and making deals so that your family can survive another day looked like and what the cost of that was.
I'm so glad you said sociopolitical dynamics. Put a pin in that because we will be getting back to more sociopolitical dynamics. But yes, continue.
But I think, you know, it's also a fantasy book that takes place in Appalachia and some creepy shit there.
Yeah. I mean, I love
those mountains are older than trees. They're older than the rings of Saturn. Depending on which fast and loose history you play with, sometimes people say they're older than bones, which I think has been disproven, but it's still a good line. They're real old. They're real old. And so, you know, there's just only so many ways that you can pop that up in a book, in a fantasy novel set there.
What I also love is in addition to using it as a way to sort of comment on the more sociopolitical aspects of capitalism and cost of capitalism, right? It also is used sometimes to just point out very simple lessons. For example, there's a moment where Verity needs to get somewhere really quickly. And so she decides to use a form of magic that she has never used before. And she's like, I know from the sacred texts that this is efficient, but for some reason, none of the adults that I know use it. And then she uses it, and it's like, it is efficient, but the process of using it is incredibly horrific. And she's like, maybe the adults are right about this one thing.
Maybe adults got that one right.
Maybe they got that one right. And so
but
I thought
also,
go ahead.
Okay, but like, an adult can tell you, don't stick your hand on the stove.
Exactly. But sometimes children have to learn by doing it.
Sometimes you have to stick your hand on the stove to learn why you don't stick your hand on the stove.
Yeah.
Because an adult telling you, even if they explain, well, you can get burned. Something, when you're five, you can get burned. There's not a lot of connection there.
Getting burned is
what does
what
that
it
mean?
And so you're just like, okay, I could get burned, I guess. You're saying it like it's a bad thing, but like, I've been through much worse. I've fallen off my tricycle or whatever. And you're like, I can get burned. And then you touch and you're like, oh, no, I can't. No, I don't.
So I have to tell you about the time that I nearly cut my thumb off because I demanded that I help my mother. We had something. Every small town has their produce-centric regional fair.
Yes. Yes.
In the fall, some people do apples. Some people do pumpkins. Where I'm from, it's yams.
Yes.
I don't know why, but it's not sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
Yams. And they will
correct.
Tell you that it's a different thing.
Yeah.
It's not a sweet potato, it's a yam. Anyways, my mother was, I think I was in kindergarten. So it's right at that age where it's like, you know, I want to help. I want to do it. No, I don't want you to hold the knife. I want to hold the knife. I want to do it. I want to help. So I did with a paring knife and I thought that I was doing it like I'd seen my mom do it. And I immediately I don't even remember which thumb it was.
So I
put it back together and like wrap it. I mean, like a good chunk of my thumb was just like off.
So you wrote from experience, and I love that for you. I'm happy your thumb is full once more.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't even remember which thumb it was.
Well,
and I actually have a little spot. You can't see it very well, but I do have a little spot here on my right pointer finger where I did the same thing with a lawnmower. I was climbing on a lawnmower in like the summer or something, and I burned my finger, and it created a little permanent scar here for me.
Oh,
not listening to the words of my parents and needing to experience it myself.
Yeah, lawnmowers, I have always found to be a little scary. I'm like, that's just not natural. It's made to destroy. I don't like that. And it's loud.
I think it was the heat of the metal.
Yeah,
I was
the heat
really
of the
young.
Motor.
I do not remember this happening. All I remember is that I had a weird scar on my finger. My parents one day, why do I have this? And they were like, oh yeah, that was the time you tried to kill yourself on the lawnmower. And we tried to stop you.
Okay, well, outside of your own life, what other movies, books, media inspired you for the body horror section?
I don't know. I think when I get into fantasy that's kind of for kids and for adults, I guess I'm really inspired by people like Guillermo del Toro. Mm. Like, you know, Pan's Labyrinth or something.
I think it's one of the best movies that's ever been made.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's one of the best things I've ever seen. But also, you know, I grew up, I didn't grow up. I found an appreciation for them as an adult of like Miyazaki films and anime and just the way that like a body decomposing, a body not being quite right.
Yeah.
You can look in someone's eyes and they're just slightly wrong, and how all of that can communicate really vital information to the viewer or the reader. I think all of those things just kind of inform me. When it comes to scary stories, I don't like slasher. I don't like slash them up. I don't like cut them up. I don't want to see people butchered, but like cosmic horror or having to like really think about like the implications. Now I'm going to sit with how this now is going to like affect these people's life forever. Like that does more for me than there's a butcher in the woods.
Yeah.
Which is bad. It's bad, but like,
how old is the horror being that you're watching? A butcher in the woods. I feel like it's so dated. But yes, no, I do understand. And also shout out to Miyazaki the Goat. I do think it's very funny to me that we have this sort of collective understanding of his movies, Howl's Moving Castle, Spirited Away, as being these sort of very beautiful, very romantic
stories. Saturday. I went to go see Spirited Away back in the movie theater. They had it replaying. My husband and I went to go see it.
That's all. I don't think I've ever actually gotten to see that one in the theaters, and it's sort of a lifelong goal for me. So I will endeavor to make that happen. But people forget that there are sections of those movies that are quite literally terrifying and disgusting.
Especially like Princess Mononoke.
Yes.
Like the body horror, the transformation sequences, the decomposition, you know, and all of that. And it's all treated like with reverence and respect. Yeah. And I mean, thinking about the opening scene where, you know, there's that boar that that was like taken over and became a demon.
Yeah.
But there is still like a reverence, and you still spoke to it with respect and, oh, ancient god of rage and hate and, you know, da 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 da. Like I just, that particular dichotomy of watching something be, you know, turned into something horrific and still speaking to it with respect, even though it's fear or awe, still finding a way to interject niceness into it or politeness or respect.
Yeah, and you know what it is? I feel like culturally, it's about understanding the balance. You know, it's about understanding that with life and all of its beauties comes death, with happiness comes anger, with war comes... Like, it's about understanding the balance. And so you have to have reverence for the negative side of the balance if you also want to enjoy the positive side of the balance, right? And I think I think indigenous cultures are really, really great at understanding that, and their media and their texts and their histories are really great at depicting that exact thing. And so it's actually, I love that you pointed that out, because that's exactly right. However, I will also pivot this into, I mean, it's all sociopolitical related, but I will also pivot it more deeply into this, because I have, so when we were texting about this, you were like, I can't wait for you to ask me trick questions. And I was like, I don't have any gotcha questions. And then I was like, well, I kind of do, but it's not really a gotcha question, because I think you have already brought up how sociopolitical this book is and the history of coal mining and these sort of business towns, these capitalist towns that were created by companies and then abandoned and left. There is a part of this book, not to spoil anything, I'll try to explain it as sort of generically as I possibly can, that breaks my heart. It is a part where Verity is sort of shunned by the town, because even though she has helped them and sacrificed quite a lot to help the town. They're only focusing on the things that she's not able to do or misunderstanding her. And I think that this story of a foreigner coming to a new place, doing the backbone, like becoming the backbone of how that place runs and functions, and then getting shunned by the place that should accept them for doing said work, is, some would say, fairly topical today. And it's not that you set out to write a book about immigration per se, but did you see that part of the book as being universal or speaking to today's current issues? Because when I realized that it had really affected me, I realized a part of why it had really affected me isn't just because of its localization within the book, but also because of how it's speaking to the sort of political climate that we're in right now.
I think that
if you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Unfortunately, don't learn enough from our history, and we are often doomed to repeat it. I think by the time this comes out, I can spoil and say Verity Vox and The Curse of Foxfire did okay, and so they are going to greenlight two more sequels. And what I hope that kids, readers of all ages, get by the end of it is that we do continue to make the same wrong choices. So the mine wars, the industry towns that were created by coal mining companies 100+ years ago, were specifically created oftentimes, especially in West Virginia, because there were unions who existed in, like, Pennsylvania. Those mining towns had unions, but the unions didn't exist in West Virginia. And there was a really bloody, many years long war, labor dispute for fairness, for equity. But mining companies would specifically recruit Italian immigrants, Irish immigrants, Black Southerners who had been freed from slavery or were newly, you know, trying to find, you know, integration into society, coming north. And the benefit to living in those towns was that everybody got paid the same. Black Southerners, Irish, Italian, and white all got paid the same, which, once again, I'm only making that distinction because at the time, Italian and Irish weren't white. Anyways, everybody got paid the same, which was a very big deal and a very big draw for all of those communities and groups. But the deal had a lot of back-end stuff that people didn't realize until they had already agreed to it. Yes, we will give you a house, but you don't actually own your house. The mining company owns your home. I don't want to give away too terribly much because a lot of this is going to inform upcoming books, but there is a particular discussion had by the owner of one of the companies who was just kind of describing what life was like for the people that lived in his town. You know, you live in my house, you eat, you buy your groceries from my store, you use my money, because they weren't actually given real currency. They were given scrip. They were given company scrip that was only worth, you know, it was dollars, you know, money, currency that they could use inside of company stores and to pay for company goods and stuff like that. You could exchange it for money, but the exchange rate was crappy. You could exchange it for U.S. currency, but it was not a favorable exchange rate. One scrip dollar did not equal one U.S. dollar by any means. But yes, you got a home, but the coal mining company owned it. And you were also going to have to pay them for it out of the wages, even though they owned it and they gave it to you. So you live in my house, you eat my food, you work in my mines. And when you die, your body is going to be buried in my mountain. These people owned nothing. There was a lot of bad deals that they made to try to have a life. Equality and equity was a fantasy for them. It was not real. And they had to fight to get that. I think that the idea of being wary of something being too good to be true, of an outsider, of the cycles of, yes, we want your help, but only so much, and you are only worth as much to us as we can get out of you, and we're going to love you when it's good, and we're going to hate you when it's bad, and when things go wrong, we're going to blame you for it. I think that that's just kind of how people work.
Yeah.
It's basic in-group, out-group dynamics. It's, you know, it's psychology, it's sociology, it's how humans work. And I don't think that you can really write a story authentically set in a place like this about the kinds of subject matter that the book is about without portraying that. And the thing is, it's not that the people of Foxfire don't have a reason to be wary of Verity. There was another magical practitioner who came to that town who also gave them a sense of ease and prosperity in the form of Earl and his deals to make your home life better, to ease your suffering, to fix your black lungs, to fix the problems with your back from days toiling, years toiling in the mines. All of that came with a cost. And they're very slow to trust Verity. And the minute that they feel proven right in their mistrust, they shut her back out. And I think that there is a lot of lessons to be learned. I think there's a lot of sadness there as well, because you are still existing in the world as Verity. Verity is the protagonist. So you know she has a good heart. You understand that she's there with pure intentions. You understand that she is the protagonist, is the main character of the story, and thus, you know, therefore and hitherto can do no wrong and all of that. She might get things wrong on occasion, but she's there to earnestly do good. But the people of that town don't know that. They only know that they have been burned by this before, and they are not going to be as easily fooled the next time. And so I hope that readers, and most readers have been able to kind of come away from it with an understanding that this is a kind of a yes and a yes both, in that it is, you know, is this a lesson to always trust the outsider who seems super helpful? No, not necessarily. You know, the townspeople have good reasons for doing and saying, kind of operating how they do. And at the same time, the reader's also like, come on, guys, come on. And it's tough and it's messy and it's complicated and there's no good answer for it. I mean, obviously, the easiest answer would be just to have everybody trust Verity, but that's not honest and that's not authentic to how people work.
You know what I'm going to go into sort of small tangents here. The first being, I had a realization in 2020 that,
we
all had many. I was one of those people who was protesting in Philly and then kettled onto the highway by the cops and then tear gassed on the highway and forced to evacuate through steep embankments and over fences and shit. It's not fun. Of course, they lost a class action lawsuit because of it. And therefore, it made me sort of very wary of future protests, which I still went to. But every time we like turned a corner, I feel like my breath caught of like, is this going to be the time? Are things going to go very downhill from here? And what I had realized in that moment is that there is a way to explain or define trauma. And I'm not going to say that's all that it is, but one could say that all trauma is robbing you of your ability to practice discernment, of your ability to like tell actually what is safe and what is not safe. And I think that this book is such a good example of that, because they are, for very good reason, unable to differentiate Verity as a magic practitioner from Earl as a magic practitioner. And they're only doing the sort of best that they can. However, so is Verity, right? And so she's like coming to this place and she's like, what is it? Why can't I get through? Why can't people necessarily see all that I've given up? And what I sort of love about it is that she also understands. She makes no sort of grand gestures to try and explain herself. When people say no, they don't want her help, she's like, okay. And when her friends point out that maybe she should try helping without magic, she's like, you know what? I'm going to get my hands dirty then. I'm going to do that. And it's sort of, she works on it in a way that accommodates for the history that the townsfolk have been through. And I really admired that. So that's my one tangent. My second tangent is,
I just want to comment on that real quick. There's something that Verity says in multiple iterations, but basically, you know, one of the primary driving forces, like how you exist as a witch in the world, is you never let them see you sweat. Witch should never let them see you flinch, never let them see you sweat. You are supposed to be the most powerful entity in the forest. You're supposed to be the most powerful person in the town. you know, your power is supposed to be authority in and of itself. People should respect you for that. And yet she also has to learn that sometimes that sweat equity is really what it takes to empathize with other people, to get on their level, to understand and to learn and to grow. And I think that, yeah, that's one of those kind of unspoken magics in the book is
absolutely.
Magic can't fix everything.
Absolutely. Somewhat similarly, have you seen Nomadland, the movie?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yeah. I think
yes.
Anyone who's listening to this, perhaps if you're an adult, because I don't remember how safe or not safe that movie is for children. So do not quote
I
me
don't
on
know
it.
That I would have. Well, I think a child would be bored watching Nomad.
I think so, too. Like, I don't remember anything bad happening, but I think they would be like, why am I watching this? However, if you
I don't know why any child would watch that movie. But hey, man, Frances McDormand is a treasure.
But
I will say
that same plot, you know, it's she.
When
the
I
reason
was
why
writing,
becomes...
people ask me sometimes who I would cast, and Frances McDormand is somebody that I've kind of like headcanned as May.
Oh, I love her.
I think she's technically too old for the character, but
she's iconic. Just write another character just for her so that we can have her. But for those who haven't seen it, the plot starts somewhat at the same. Like the part of the reason why she becomes a nomad is because she works within and for a company town. And when they shut the plant down and her husband has already passed, she then is sort of left adrift, right? She has no ties to anything. She has no money. She hasn't, like, living in that town. Like you were saying, living in that town sort of disenfranchises you from being able to exist anywhere else just because of the way it naturally works and the sort of mechanism of capitalism and how it's working there. And so I think it's a very interesting movie to watch as an adult as a sort of counterpart to this. So that is my second tangent. I will pivot to my final question. And it's sort of a question for me. There has been a lot of like hullabaloo about how kids these days don't read in the third person omniscient point of view, which is what you wrote Verity in.
Yeah.
I don't even know what my question is. I guess my question is sort of like, we're sort of unsure if this is even a real thing. Like, I don't know if there's been any hard statistics, or we're taking this with a grain of salt.
No, it is. It is.
Okay. Okay.
I did all the things you're not supposed to do in a book. Like around one third of readers will not read a book if it has a prologue in it. Like they won't read prologues, or they make buying decisions if a book has a prologue in it. Editors will not pick up a book if it has a prologue in it. In fact, one of the first notes that I got when the book was picked up was, okay, so first thing we're going to do is cut the prologue, and we are going to put all of this in like a chapter 3 flashback or a chapter 3 rundown. So, you know, the chapter 3 info dump. That's kind of a famous thing in science fiction and fantasy, is you get to like somewhere around chapter 3 to 5, and then you get your info dump on what the world is and how the world came to be, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. So I'd fight to have a prologue. Yeah, people hate third person, especially these days. I don't entirely know why. Some people say that it's because it's harder for the reader to self-insert. I don't know. I mean, that's not true for every reader, so I can't say that that's like some definitive reason or something. But yeah, people don't really like third person. But I mean, it comes and goes. You know, we used to prioritize third person. It's, I don't know. I mean, stuff comes and goes. Stuff's in vogue and then it's out of vogue and stuff. But yeah, I did a lot of things that I think I wasn't supposed to do in the book. But I don't know. I think if you do them well, you can get away with them.
Yeah, I guess my question is just sort of like, why did you ever think of shifting point of views for this book? Or were you just like, it's got to be third person?
No, I wanted this to feel like a folktale, like you were sitting on your front porch or sitting around a fire. And that aunt, that uncle, that cousin who's just really good at telling you the family lore is telling you a story of what happened and how it happened, which is why it doesn't actually always stay in third person. Sometimes the narrator breaks the fourth wall and talks directly to you, the reader. Sometimes the narrator seems to have an understanding of present day. You know, whenever the narrator's discussing the magic of hospitality, about how your mom probably has a box somewhere in your house of small gifts, you know, candles or sweet smelling. I didn't use the word potpourri because I didn't want to Google when the word existed. Whether or not it would have been appropriate, I do include it. You know, and all of that, and, you know, discussing the magic of giving gifts and ensuring that you are always prepared to be a good hostess or a good visitor to somebody else's home. Yeah, I don't know that I had any strong opinions about writing a book in a particular thing, like to prove some kind of point or something. I just, that was the only way that I knew to write this story. And also, well, just a lot of the books that I read growing up, they were third person.
Yeah, same.
I don't even know how I would have authentically written this inside of Verity's head. That would have been a strange perspective for me. I did before this. Verity's not the first novel that I wrote. The first novel that I wrote is this big adult science fiction thing, and that was all. It was multi POV, and all of the POVs were first person. So maybe I was just taking a break from that. I don't know.
Well, I'm very grateful because I tend to be very fond of third person omniscient. I'm also very fond of just shifting points of view throughout texts. But I mean, the third person was certainly most of what I grew up reading. And so I felt very comforted by the fact that it's still alive and well in some regards. Those are all of my questions.
I grew up with Wizard of Earthsea. I grew up with The Lost Years of Merlin. I grew up with Animorphs. I grew up with, Animorphs, I think, is first person. But The Dark is Rising, Susan Cooper. I mean, just everything I read growing up, there was a storyteller.
And I love narrators and like narration as technique, as device. I think it's so fun because you can play so much in that space. I mean, The Book Thief being a really great example of playing with narrator, and a book that I read as a kid that I was like, oh my God, I didn't even know you could do this. So I really appreciated that. Those are all of my questions. I will let everyone who's watching this, listening to this, in on a little Journalism 101, which is my last question as always. Is there anything I didn't ask or any topic we didn't cover that you would like to say or mention?
Not necessarily, but a lot of the stuff that was subtext in book one is going to be a lot more text in future books. You know, I was talking
Congrats.
Earlier about how these towns were created and specifically recruited oppressed groups. Rich people had a reason for doing that because they were hoping, especially in West Virginia where there were no unions, they were hoping that if they stuck them in, they would create these towns, they would create these areas, but they would keep them segregated. So they would only allow the Italians to live in the Italian areas and the Blacks to live with the Blacks and the Irish and so on and so forth. And they did that in hopes that they would be so busy fighting one another that they would never band together and rise up against the wealthy. That's specifically why they did that. And what ended up happening is people just got to know one another. They got to know one another when they were in the mines, because when you're covered in coal, everybody looks the same. Mm-hmm. So it didn't work. There ended up being, you know, some rather bloody labor uprisings. And I just think that is kind of the important message that I hope comes through in this story and future stories in the world of Foxfire, is that we have a lot more in common than we do differences. And for all of the tension, for all of the love hate that we have, that I have for small towns, for all of that, I do still think that there is a beauty somewhere deep down in there that can be embraced. I don't know. I hope that the message of the book of community and found family and watching out for one another, because, you know, we're all humans, I hope that that's what people take away from it.
Yay. Well, I loved it. I can't wait for the future books. Congrats on those, by
Thank
the
you.
Way. Very excited to read them. Very excited for the years ahead for you.
I can't wait to start writing them.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to also get some rest. That also would be nice as your friend to see you do that. Well, this has been Head on Fire, Nadira edition, the tables turned edition. Thanks everyone for listening. And Dawn, we'll see you back at some point with somebody who most likely will not be me, but have fun with that.
Thank you. Bye. Nadira, if people want to find you on social media, how can they do that?
Yeah. Wow. Oh my God. A little bit of self promo. You can find me on most platforms at Call Me Nadira, but that's call with three L's because someone else I do not know has the two L version. So C-A-L-L-L, me, Nadira. And then you can
rude
also
of them. Rude.
It is rude. And, you know, I have complained about them to anyone who will listen. And you can also find me under most often the culture and human interest sections at slate.com. And that's it for me.
Thank you for doing this. And thanks for visiting Foxfire with me. Hope you'll come back soon.
I can't wait. And don't look in the trees.
Don't look in the trees. Don't whistle in the woods at night. Don't answer if you hear your name called. And remember...
And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest host and good buddy, Nadira Goff. Make sure to go read all of Nadira's articles over on Slate. She actually did a really fascinating breakdown on the slop bowls that we all eat for lunch these days. Fascinating, incredible journalism about something that you never think about. Anyways, Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire is currently available in ebook, audiobook, and hardcover everywhere books are sold, or just check it out from your local library. It's pretty great. The audiobook was read by Jennifer Hale, and she does a freaking incredible job. Honestly, I was the writer of the book, and I, like, learned things about the novel from listening to her do it that I hadn't even, like, considered. Like, some subtext was made text, and so, like, it was just, I was like, oh my gosh, there's layers here, which sounds like I'm blowing smoke up my own butt, but I'm honestly, it's just like, that is the gift of a true artist like Jennifer Hale that can elevate some work like mine into like real art and real performance the way that she did it. Anyways, thank you all so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for downloading and sharing the show. If you would like to connect with me on social media, I am at By Don Martin on all platforms, BYDONMARTIN. That is also the name of my website, bydonmartin.com, where you can find links to all of my other books, like my upcoming audiobook that comes out next week, November 4th, Where Did Everybody Go? It's a nonfiction deep dive on the loneliness epidemic, and I really do hope that you all will pivot and head over and download that and spend some time with me in your ears learning about loneliness. Anyways, I will talk to you all later. Thank you so much. And remember, never stop seeking illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Happy Halloween!
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.